Impact of Influence, the Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth.
Hello, friend. Matt Harris and Seton Tucker here, and we're always so grateful that you decided to spend some time with us. Lots of things to do and lots of things to listen to. We're so pleased, and we would love it if you would rate the episode, comment on it, especially if it's a good one, and share the episode, and so more and more people can hear what we're doing. We'd love it. Murdoch Podcast on Facebook, Matt Harris Podcast at gmail.com.
And speaking of things to listen to, there is a new podcast coming out called The Presumption, which is going to be put on by Jim Griffin, the attorney for Alec Murdoch, and Sarah Azari.
So this Murdoch case has sprung up a few with Eric Bland, who represented the Satterfields as a podcast, and now a member of the defense team for Alec Murdoch has a podcast.
And all of those people we have had on our podcast.
That's exactly true.
Room for everyone.
Yeah, we bring them all on. Bring them all on. Well, speaking of Eric Bland,
there does not seem to be a lot of love lost between Eric Bland and Jim Griffin and Dick Harpootlian. We talked about this motion that Jim Griffin and Dick Harpootlian filed to vacate the confession of judgment to the Satterfield family. And now we have a response from Bland and Richter on behalf of the Satterfield family.
And in the memorandum, it says, at its heart, the defendant's motion for relief from judgment pursuant to South Carolina Civil Procedure Rule 60B, the motion, asks one simple question. May I have a mulligan? More aptly described, though, their motion, Team Murdoch, which includes Murdoch and his counsel, have stumbled late on the judicial first tee with a small bucket of balls and with the apparent attempt to fire shots until they finally hit the fairway. Obviously, Murdoch is not a golfer. Neither are his lawyers. There are no mulligans. Like a spoiled child, the motion is overindulged and undisciplined. Murdoch's argument seems to be, because I committed fraud on the court in the underlying case, I am entitled to be relieved of my confessed judgment now. And by the memorandum, the plaintiffs will expose the many whiffs, slices, tops, blocks, chunks, hooks, and duffs that have so needlessly wasted this court's time and have unnecessarily caused the further victimization of the Satterfield family, thus entitling the plaintiffs to sanction against both Murdoch and his legal counsel in order to punish their conduct and deter such similar abuses of the plaintiffs and the legal system going forward.
They're not meeting up at the golf course anytime soon.
No, a lot of golf references in there, and there's many of them in the filing as well.
It's one of the more entertaining legal documents I've read.
We've read a lot of dry ones over the last few years of following Murdoch and Beach Trial and all those. This definitely has some pizzazz, and I wonder who the judge is going to hear the case. Are they playing up to the judge? Maybe that judge loves golf, and they'll get a little in there, you know?
Yeah, we'll see.
And so they go on and talk about, they called the item number one, whiff. And they go on, and a lot of the wording in here is not straight up legalese. It is, okay, you know, shots at Murdoch and his team. If you didn't hear the episode where we talked about this, originally when Gloria Satterfield fell, Alec was saying to everybody that the dogs knocked her over and caused her to fall. He even said at one point that Gloria told him that. And I'm summarizing this in a short version. Then he comes out later, just a month ago or so, and says the dogs did not cause Gloria to fall.
Yeah, he says he lied about that, so this whole settlement should have never happened in the first place because he made the whole thing up.
It was fraud, so the 4.3 that he got should not go to the Satterfields, but Blaine Richter said, we don't want to jump in front of the line because we've got a bunch of money through other
settlements,
people,
the bank and Bank of America and Palmetto State Bank and the Corey Fleming's law firm.
Yeah, and so they said, well, we'll just wait in line. But now Alec and his team are saying, well, it was all fraud. We're not going to give the 4.3.
Well, I think this is a good time to bring up that I've had a couple of experienced insurance adjusters reach out to me, and they found this $4.3 million settlement unusual. They had never seen this type of settlement in their years of experience. This person actually tweeted me, "I've been in the insurance business for 12 years. I've seen many claims from my insureds. I read trade journals nearly every day, take CE classes, often attend insurance company meetings about claims. With or without the dogs, I've never seen a $3.3 million payout in similar circumstances."
It is huge. And again, though, maybe it is just way off the regular scale in certain counties. Yeah. I don't know how far up, and Chad mentioned that when we talked to him.
Chad disagreed. He felt that the venue, maybe that was the reason why this settlement was agreed upon by the insurance company.
Very good. Now let's move to our guest. He is Michael DeWitt Jr., Hampton County native, multiple award-winning journalist, longtime editor of the Hampton County Guardian, did a lot of great stories for Gannett's Nationwide USA Today Network, appeared on ABC's 2020, 48 Hours, various Murdoch documentaries. And Michael served as a volunteer historian, storyteller, and playwright for the five-county Sakahatchee Stew Oral History. And he is a good guy. He's been real nice to us over the last few years. We've had him before. Wicked Hampton County is the name of the book. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Morning. So right out of the gate, I will look at this one quote you have in the preface, which is, "I know much about greatness and much about wickedness and scandal, and I have an appreciation for both. Perhaps that is why I became a storyteller for my community." And when we've talked over this few years of doing the Murdoch stuff, you often brought up the storytelling thing and how I get the vibe from you that that's more of a passion than, say, investigative journalism.
That's right. I'm by nature, it's not my natural nature to be an investigative journalist. I don't have the curious mind that a really good investigative journalist has. I'm more of a storyteller. I have to be a journalist, and I do my best, and some days I do well, some days better than others. But my passion is in the story and in the characters, and and communicating with the readers and luring them in with a good story.
In your preference, you talk about your aunt Edna, who would share her memories, but her stories were different. She spoke of great tragedy and wicked deeds and people's battle with alcohol and demons. And this was the person I always wanted to sit next to at Thanksgiving lunch.
Get the dirt. Yep.
Yep. How has your family and community reacted to this book?
My family's been very supportive. I don't know if every one of them had time to sit down and read it just yet, but they know a lot of, they know our family stories, and they've been very supportive. The community, for the most part, here in Hampton County have been supportive. There have been a few negative reactions and responses. Primarily, some of the locals take offense to the title, Wicked Hampton County, and they think that the book is telling the world that Hampton County is a wicked place and we're all horrible people. And that's not true. I've tried to explain to people that this is a series. The History Press and Arcadia Publishing is a national or international publishing company. And they have several series, like my first history book was Images of America. It's a nationwide series with over 1,200 titles at the time. And Wicked is a series. There's a Wicked Beaufort, Wicked Charleston, Wicked Greenville. It appeals to people's interest in historical true crime, and it was just a perfect fit for the Wicked series. So the title is Wicked Hampton County. So other than that small negative reaction just from a few locals who probably get offended by a lot of things they shouldn't be offended by, it's been mostly supportive throughout the community and had a great turnout for my first book signing in Walterboro, and we've kicked off the book tour, and hopefully we'll continue to have some good support.
We all have pasts, and Hampton Shirley does as well. And a quote that I read from your book was, out of war, ruin, racism, fear, and hate, Hampton County was born. A lot of our past, we can say these bad things, but that doesn't necessarily define the future.
That's right. And I try to make it clear in the book that Hampton County is no different. It's no worse or no better than any other place. I mean, we happen to be named for a Confederate general who owned slaves, you know, but there are other counties and towns out there named for similar historical figures. You know, our history, you know, in the book, we talk about the Klan and lynchings and things of that nature. I just sat down with two people who drove from Alabama to see the Lowcountry and purchased two copies of the book. And they were telling me, you know, they're from Alabama. The same thing happened in every county in Alabama. Same thing happened in Georgia. So, you know, Hampton County isn't unique in that regard. You know, wicked things happened in that time period around the country. But I'm not telling those stories. I'm telling the story of my hometown, my community. And I asked the questions, you know, a lot of locals didn't know much of the things in this book. You know, we hear about the Klan rallies and the lynchings, and we thought, well, that happened somewhere else. That happened over in Mississippi. That didn't happen here. Well, it happened here too. And a lot of things here people didn't know about. Locals who weren't old enough didn't know that Notre Dame University students had to come here and help locals sign up to get the right to vote. And we had civil rights marches here, and we had a standoff at the county jail, and Buster Murdoch and all the state police were there, and college students were protesting and had a sit-in so people could get the right to vote. We thought these things happened in Selma, Alabama, or somewhere else, but they happened right here too. And but again, in the beginning of the book, and I asked the question, you know, now that we fully know our past, where do we go from here? What can we learn, and how can we make the future better?
Yeah, you don't shy away from it. You go into some of the lynchings, just sickening of what had happened, and you don't try to paint a pretty stroke. You are pretty hardcore about telling the stories. And you mentioned Notre Dame. That's a story about in the late 60s, students from Notre Dame, St. Mary's, Holy Cross Junior College came down to Hampton County to organize and help its black citizens register to vote while overcoming voter suppression tactics. And it was huge news even nationally. And the students were not greeted kindly by the white citizens or officials in power. And you dive into that story and quote some of the Notre Dame student activists were there and some of the Klan marches and stuff. And it was just bad times for sure. I just found out a fun fact from Seton.
Yes, my dad was a Yankee student who came down and marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma.
Wow, that's great. You know, my father often talks about one of his big regrets in life was not going down to march. He said he just kind of wasn't aware of it as much as he wished he would have been in a tiny little small town in Pennsylvania. And he always watches specials. He tears up when he talks about it. Let's talk a little bit about the riot of 1880 and Governor Wade Hampton. This all was coming about because of the special election that had gone on, and there was all kinds of voter fraud and voter registration problems and voting restriction problems. Give us a little bit of background on that real quick.
Wade Hampton had just been elected governor of the state, and, you know, so statewide there was some turmoil, and it carried through to the local election. So the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, went at it hot and heavy. I think that year someone was killed on election day at the courthouse. The Hampton County Courthouse used to have a ground floor that was open. And somebody was stabbed and killed right there on the ground floor of the courthouse. Jeez. A voter was coming back from the polls, and was the voter and his mule were shot and killed by buckshot. Oh, there was a train wreck caused by sabotage. There was a jailbreak. All kinds of things happened in this lovely little election of 1880. And I thought it was an interesting thing to start the book off.
Sounds a lot like some of our current day elections. Mm. It was hotly contested. Hampton emerged as the winner on paper, but Governor Chamberlain contested those results.
refused to step down even. Crazy times.
Yeah, crazy.
And there was a lot of cheating going on, a lot of ballot stuff. And I think in one election, the Democrats won by exactly 10,000 votes over the total number of registered voters. So however many registered voters there were in the county, 10,000 mysterious votes appeared and on top of that. And so there was a lot of cheating on both sides. And there was a lot of violence and strong arm activity on both sides. Wade Hampton had his red shirts, and they were basically a paramilitary group that, you know, former Confederate soldiers. And wherever he went on campaign, they went and to either drum up support or, you know, use the threat of violence to get people to vote. And there was a lot of violence against the other party and against Black citizens. Well, the Republicans did the same thing. They'd sweep into town and they'd harass and intimidate and use violence against the Democrats. So it was a very, very rough time period to get involved in politics. Like the mule, I wrote in the book, the politically unaffiliated mule was killed. So you didn't have to necessarily be a Democrat or Republican to get caught up in that violence.
Right.
You describe Hampton in its early days as kind of like the Wild West, but you call it the Wild East.
Yeah. You say it was late 1800s, early 1900s. There was livestock roaming the streets, and there was gunfights and robberies. And this will be interesting kind of to the people who followed the Murdoch trial. And remember, they kept talking about the wild hogs.
Yes, a lot of hog hunting.
A lot of hog hunting stuff. And this is early 1900s. He wrote about how in the South Carolina low country, they had massive alligators and mammoth wild hogs to contend with. The giant porkers ranged in and out of the Sakahatchee and Coosawatchee swamps. Did I say it right?
I think so.
Destroying farmland and sometimes even the occasional hapless hunter and his dogs. In 1941, this guy killed a mammoth hog weighing 400 pounds with five tusks, measuring 5 inches, and bottom tusk was over 3 inches. And they kept these giant, massive hogs running around. And we mentioned the robberies.
Yeah, there were train robberies, and maybe some things haven't changed because I think you just reported on a train robbery recently in Hampton.
That's right. Right here in Estill, in the southern part of the county. The human heart hasn't changed. Crime, the sins of murder and theft, they'll never go away. Just the methods have changed. So whereas back then, you know, the train robbers were out looking for cash or gold or whatever the trains were carrying, whatever was in the banks, these guys here in Estill a month or so ago were looking to steal catalytic converters off of vehicles.
Okay.
And they actually cut a hole in the side of the train and were trying to cut the catalytic converters out of the cars they were transporting. So interesting new take on a age-old type of crime.
Have they been caught, by the way?
No, they've arrested one of the suspects, the man who stood on the tracks and flagged the train down. They identified him and they got him, but they haven't got his accomplices yet.
Let's talk a little about the Murdoch, since that's what this podcast has been about mostly for the last few years. And they were almost 100 years in power. And if you jump into the 60s and early 70s, civil rights violations in the town of Hampton, voting issues, how did the Murdoch family, especially Randolph Buster Murdoch Jr., deal with this? Where did they fit in this history? What side were they on? What light can you shed on that?
The Murdochs were a little different. I mean, they were Democrats. While they may have had some moments that might be questionable, like when the sit-in protests happened, the civil rights protests happened at the old jail, Buster Murdoch was there, and he wasn't on the side of the protesters by any means. But at the same time, they were Democrats. In more modern times, the Murdochs have been involved and members of the NAACP. They're politicians, white or black. As long as you're, you know, a Democrat, you're on their side. You're their buddy. They shake your hand. They know your name, and you could argue the only color that matters really to people like that is the color green. So I don't really put them in a strong racial context in this book.
Yeah.
Something in your book that stood out to me was that Buster made deals with black and white leaders to keep the peace because he didn't like having troubles in his hometown. So this certainly sounds like a politician to me.
Yeah, and I didn't go into as much detail in there because I couldn't prove every single thing. The source, the historian that talked to me, you know, I didn't want to name names and go into too much detail, but that was the basic idea behind it. Buster didn't want trouble in his quiet hometown. You know, he sat down with black leaders and he made a deal with them. I think there's a story of that one of them had some criminal charges and pending against him, maybe involving a woman or something like that. And he said, you know, I'll make your legal troubles go away if you can, you know, let's cut down on some of these marches and these protests. And then he goes to the Klan and he tells them, look here, you know, you can do that over in Collier County all day long, but don't bring it to Hampton County. And so basically by talking to both sides, he and that's kind of been a pattern throughout what I've seen throughout the Murdoch dynasty. You know, Hampton, Barnville, this is our quiet hometown. We don't, you know, we don't want dirt in our backyard. You do it somewhere else in the circuit and we'll deal with it, you know. And I just found that to be very interesting.
I did too.
You know, you've got the power and the influence to run the Klan out of town with just a handshake.
Wow. Yeah, that's power. You mentioned in the book that he ran the out-of-town Klan members, but left the local racists here to settle down their own. So, I mean, you can he had the influence, but it wasn't like he was taking a stand, really. Just, we want peace here, go be a Klan somewhere else or be racist. I mean, it would have been a lot better if he just called everybody out and said, don't be bigoted a-holes, but whatever. I'll settle for that.
Let's move on to Handsome, who was Buster's son, and he was called Handsome after the birth of his granddaughter. He chose the nickname Handsome because he always wanted to be called handsome by women. I had some compassion for him because when he was only 9 years old, he accompanied his father, who was known as Buster, to a farmer who's had, I guess, killed his sister in some sort of grisly way.
Yes, it was a gruesome murder.
Yes, and he heard this confession from this farmer about killing his sister.
Buster and young Randolph were sitting on the banks of a river fishing, and in Collier County, he taking his son fishing. There was no court that week, whatever. And the county sheriff comes to get him and said, "We've got this man that wants to confess to killing his sister, but he said he only talked to Buster. He won't talk to us. He wants to talk to you. He trusts you." And so they leave the fishing hole and he takes young Randolph with him and they hear this heartbreaking confession. And Randolph told me in a 2018 interview I did with him that he felt sorry for both of them. The old man was old. He was sick. His sister was sick. He didn't want to be the person responsible for the old man spending the rest of his days in jail. He just wanted to, you know, stay out of it. And his daddy's like, you know, you're going to testify if I have to declare you a hostile witness. That's how
nine.
Randolph tells the story that daddy was going to make him a hostile witness. And when Buster told the story to a reporter years later, Buster said that told it a different way, but said he was going to make his son stand in court and hold his subpoena. And then, of course, there's another story where Randolph thought subpoena was something dirty. His daddy told him he was going to have to hold a subpoena, and Randolph thought he was talking about something dirty.
Oh, no.
And Buster had a flair for the drama, which got him in trouble with the ethics board numerous times. One of the times was there was a murderer, John Bowers, who was an Estill storekeeper, and I guess lost his mind, murdered his wife, son, and daughter in a gruesome way with a baseball bat. And so Bowers had confessed to Randolph Buster Murdoch Jr. that he waited his family to return home from a movie and then turned on them one by one because he said his wife and he had not been getting along well. And in really cold, gruesome murder, but in his closing remarks, Buster said, quote, "John Bowers has to be removed from society by electrocution if Hampton County is to be made a safe place in which to live. If he is ever released on society and kills again, no one is responsible but yourselves. Very dramatic.
Yeah, there were a lot of cases like that. And the Supreme Court, you know, so a lot of his convictions were overturned. A lot of his death row cases were brought back. And some of them were reconvicted and eventually were executed. And some of them were set free because of something that Buster did or said in the courtroom. He said things like, if you don't find this man guilty of rape, I've got another murder rape trial come up this afternoon. I'll just turn that rapist free. Or, you know, I'll never prosecute another murder case in this county ever again if you don't find this person guilty. So he would say and do things to coerce and threaten the jury and intimidate them. And the Supreme Court, you know, did not agree with a lot of things he did.
Well, this still baseball bat slayer John D. Bowers killing his family. I don't know if there was this cold-blooded killing of a family until Alec Murdoch was convicted. And the whole court case, you write about it in here, it was a lot of drama involved.
During the trial, Buster took the baseball bat, the murder weapon, and handed it to the jury boy. And the jury boy was just swinging it and playing with it in court. And what? The judge thought that was inappropriate. So he took the murder weapon from the kid and made the kid leave the courtroom, told his mom to come get him. And so lots of horrible but fascinating things in that particular trial as well. And that man spent some time in what they call the lunatic asylum on Bull Street and spent the rest of his life in prison, obviously.
Can you please also write a book on Bull Street? Because I think there's a lot of stories to be told there as well.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk about Banker Bowden, who opened this loan and exchange bank in 1907, which was the predecessor to what we now know as Palmetto State Bank. He seemed like quite a character. In the book, you describe a story where a new young doctor had moved to town and he didn't have any money. And Bowden asked him what sort of collateral he could put up, and he said he didn't have anything other than his wife and children.
Some days my kids will not be worth a lot of collateral.
Well, he took their names and wrote them down as collateral.
Yeah, and I guess that was just on paper. I don't know what would have happened if the bank would have tried to collect on that collateral, but yeah, he, you know, if you came to him and you wanted to borrow money for copper pipe, copper tubing, and things of that nature, that you were clearly making a moonshine operation, he would loan you the money. He was quicker to loan money on a mule than he was those newfangled Ford cars they had back then. And he would go out there and check the mule's teeth and make sure he was a good investment. And I didn't add this to the book because I found this out later, but I talked to a younger person who remembered the banker, and he said he was kind of in his later years, he was kind of a deranged, not deranged, but kind of an eccentric. That's a good word. An eccentric man. He, you know, every time you saw him, he had a pistol in one pocket and a bottle of liquor in the other. He just struck me as a most interesting character. I know his family and his descendants. I want to make it clear. He was not a wicked character. He was never accused of breaking any laws, but he certainly did business his own way. And
befriended a robber.
He did what, Seton?
He befriended a robber, which I thought that was really kind of interesting. There, he did some sort of interview with a bank robber and asked if they might be able to break into his bank.
That's right. And that story made, I can't remember the name of the TV show, but NBC had a national TV show and radio program back in the day when people sat around and listened to the radio and didn't have TVs, or very few people had TVs. NBC had a radio show that would be on the radio on Thursday nights and on TV on Friday nights or something like that. And this reformed bank robber, he was Big Jim Norton or something like that. And he had got caught and did his time. And now he was kind of a celebrity former robber. And he invited him. He didn't invite him to Hampton, to anywhere near the bank. He invited him out to the Savannah River to his fish camp to have dinner with him and talk about, bank robbing and weaknesses in the bank and things of that nature. But just a very, very interesting story.
I know a lot of people know about Pat Conroy, the Beaufort County novelist, and he's been mentioned a lot during this Murdoch time. They're like, that's kind of book, this whole thing, this reality would be what Pat Conroy would write about. And in the book, you talk about an encounter that Randolph Buster Murdoch Jr. had with Pat Conroy, and Conroy wrote about it in his memoir, The Death of Santini, The Story of a Father and His Son. Describe that meeting to us.
He described meeting Buster, and somebody pointed out to me that Conroy was a fiction writer. So like any good fiction writer, he's going to embellish a little bit. But he described meeting Buster, and Buster said, I'm the cock of the walk in these here parts. And he offered, he said, you've got the gift. He said, you'd make a fine lawyer. Let me send you to law school, and I'll make you the damnedest lawyer you've ever seen. And Pat Conroy turned him down and said, no, I'll stick to teaching and writing. And but I found that to be that little scene, I think, is very telling of Buster's personality. Just very cocky, just very, self-centered, self-important. And I think it described Buster Murdoch to a T.
Yeah.
And I know you talk a lot more about the Murdochs in another book you have coming out. Tell us about your new book, The Fall of the House of Murdoch.
I'm finishing up now, and hopefully we'll be out in August no later in September. So there are a lot of the historical Murdoch stories that I go into more detail, and I saved some really good stories for that book.
Good.
That I really wanted to slip in here, but I said, I've got to save something for round two.
Let's go back to the book we're talking about now, Wicked Hampton County. And you dedicate the book to the future of Hampton County, our children. Where will we go from here? Tell us about this dedication.
Well, I reference a history book that was published in 1971. Called Both Sides of the Swamp. If you're from Hampton County, you know the Coosahatchee River and the Saucatchie River run through our county. And, we have, just like in Beaufort County, you have north of Broad and south of Broad, kind of a geographic boundary that also becomes a cultural or economic boundary in a place. And here in our county, what's south of the swamp on 601 is our South District, Estill, Garnet, Luray, and north of the swamp is Hampton, Varnville, the larger towns, the county seat. And years ago, when we used to have many, many school districts, and then gradually we ended up having two public school districts, and during integration, the South District remained a high minority, poor rural school district in the north part of the county, fared a lot better. They took to integration a little better, let's just say it like that. And we've always had both sides of the swamp. Well, here recently, within the past year or two, our two public school districts have consolidated into one unified school district. And we've gotten some state funding, and we're about to build a new consolidated high school that will bring all students of the county together in one school. And it's kind of symbolic. I end the book with this, that after all these hundreds of years, both sides of the swamp are now finally unified into one. Maybe this is a sign of the future. And Wade Hampton High School, which is where I graduated, this graduating class that will march this coming Friday night will be the last graduating class of Wade Hampton High School. After that, the school will be named simply Hampton County High School. And it's just changing times. Our past is behind us. Both sides of the swamp have come together. And now it's time to, now that we know the sins of our past and we are starting to come together, where do we go from here?
Michael, that's one of the things I really appreciate how you wrote the book, was that warts and all, it is there. You didn't ignore those painful, awful parts of history in the county, and that you deserve credit for that, because you could have just written a pretty pose about all the Southern belles and sitting on drinking iced tea and all that, but nope, you uh, you got down and dirty, and that's just part of the way it was and the way it will never be again, we can hope. Well,
and not just for Hampden County, for everybody. Right. I mean, I actually had the same thing with my own family. I had a family member tell me a terrible story about someone else, and the other family member didn't speak to that family member for a very long time. So
just within families themselves.
Yeah,
yep.
It's just part of it, part of life.
Where can they get this book, Michael?
Well, if you're an internet shopper and you don't want to leave the comfort of your computer, you can just go to Arcadia Publishing and search, put in Wicked Hampden County. It'll take you to my author page. You can go to Amazon. I have an author page on Amazon. I will be having events all around the Lowcountry and later the upstate. June 16th, I'll be at the Colleton County Courthouse again, which is where the murder trial of Alex Murdaugh was held. We had a very successful book signing on last Friday, and I'm looking forward to an even bigger crowd on the 16th in Walterboro. I'm also excited about this. During the Watermelon Festival on June 23rd, I will be at the Hampden Library from 4 to 6 p.m. June 23rd. It's the day of the big street dance, so I'm hoping people will come and pay me a visit. Get your book signed. Let me tell you a story or two, and then go enjoy the Watermelon Festival. Go to the street dance. Have a good time. Shake a leg. In July, I'll be in Allendale, South Carolina, Ridgeland, which is in Jasper County, and probably Beaufort. So got a good summer tour planned. And I'll take a little break and get Fall of Murdaugh out, and then we'll do it again.
Well, I'm going to come get my book signed.
Yep. Michael, appreciate it very much. And we will talk again.
Great. Yeah. Well, come on to Hampden, or come to Walterboro. Let's have a little reunion, and I'll sign your book, and we'll swap stories. How about that?
Love it. Love it. Before we wrap, we got a nice positive review. So we'll relish in that moment. The Apple Review says, I started listening to this podcast after Alex Murdaugh was convicted. I've really enjoyed Seton and Matt's perspective and breaking down that episode's information. I personally not watch the news because of skewed opinions, so I appreciate they brought guests to the table from the defense, prosecution, experts in the fields of whatever information was being presented at the time. I believe Matt and Seton did a great journalistic duty during this podcast and looking at all sides of the spectrum to give the most fair commentary. At the end of the day, this is a podcast, and Seton and Matt might have given their opinions based on evidence or information at that point, which I thought was fantastic. As listeners, we don't have to agree or with their opinion. May have different perspectives, and that's okay. Great job, Matt and Seton. I hope you continue this journey. I thought your podcast was a great way to have discourse because so many of us were having these same conversations. Thank you.
We appreciate it.
And then right under that, please prepare better. Okay. We'll ignore that one.
Well, no, sometimes we do need to prepare better.
Yeah,
that's true.
We take all of the feedback, positive, negative, whatever, and we chew on it and try to get better every single time. Check out the Murdaugh Podcast Facebook page, Matt Harris Podcast at gmail.com. We're grateful. We'll talk soon, friend.